Hello, everyone, and welcome to JeffG tonight. Still multi-streaming tonight. I've published mostly the link around Odyssey because I saw yesterday that we were still scoring higher audience numbers on Odyssey. But I have also enabled the Rumble stream because there were so many problems lately with Odyssey. I think that having a second choice might be important. Yesterday, the super chat on Rumble worked. I found out that they take 20% of it. So definitely, Odyssey is still the favored platform for super chats because they take much less. But Rumble takes 20%. End of the line, Joel says, Jeff, last year, the Washington Redskins NFL team changed their name to the Washington Commanders. This pressure seemed to mostly come from white liberal allies. Now there are Native American groups demanding the team change their name and picture logo back to the Redskins. What does this situation say about white liberals and their ability to find problems with everything? And he sends a link from Fox News. Yeah, this story is exemplar. It's been happening again and again on the left. They had the same thing with LGBT monetization. So because most people talking about LGBT stuff were actually right-wingers criticizing the philosophy, you had a phenomenon where the algorithms of YouTube, following demands of white liberals, were tuned to make it a controversial subject. Now, if you're a controversial subject, you're not getting monetized. And now suddenly you were finding yourself with just regular LGBT people who weren't so ideological about it, but they just happened to be gay or trans and they just wanted to live their life. And yet every time they would make a video about themselves, it would get demonetized. So that's a perfect example of why we need exactly what Alan Dershowitz has proposed to Elon Musk. We need a circle of definitions that is symmetrical, that doesn't attack the left more than the right, that doesn't try to identify controversy by content. Because when you do controversy by content, the problem is the leftists have it in their mind that, oh my God, we're going to censor the right-wingers and we're going to be the only ones left. But what they don't understand is eventually they get censored too, because you just define this subject as controversial. So you created a situation where your life has become controversial. That is why we need an arbitrary defined circle that says everything of discussions of that nature are acceptable on every political side, or discussions of that nature are unacceptable on every political side, no matter what. Once we get this, we get a form of justice in the management of social media. All right, there's lots of... The question of Jewish power is totally upfront in the public conversation again. And we got a couple of comments that I will review from Brett Weinstein. And yes, Brett Weinstein shows exactly the kind of symptoms that I would like to fix in society. This kind of, well, I don't know if I should listen to any critique of Israel or Jews or Jewish power questions, because I cannot know. It's hard to know. It's hard to disentangle what comes from a hatred place and what is legitimate critique. And the answer to this for Brett is you don't get to disentangle this, just like I don't get to disentangle this. What do I do if I'm in a debate and the leftist comes up with a point? Do I have the luxury of ignoring their point by saying, oh, well, I think it comes from a hateful place against, I don't know, Christians or white people. I think it comes from a hateful place, and so I'm not addressing your concerns. No. If we are a society of public conversation, a good argument must be addressed, and a bad argument must be debunked or attacked. No matter who it comes from, it is ultimately a big ad hominem to be thinking like Brett Weinstein, oh, well, what if it comes from a place of hatred? Well, even if hatred was the motivating emotion behind a good point, I would want to undermine this good point if I was in a debate. I would want to engage with that point and leave aside everything about who it comes from and where it comes from and what motivated it. Because ultimately, if it's a good point, someone else could be doing it. And if it's a good point, therefore, it needs to be addressed. I mean, those were basic tenets of, I would say, the secularist community, people making arguments around rationality and pushing for rationality. We cannot engage in a rational public discourse if attribution of intent dominates a given question. Like, if to every point that was done to me in a debate, I would reply, oh, well, this comes from this emotion. So what? If it's a good point, someone else without that emotion could be doing it. So what if it comes from hatred or not? And so it is only in a tortured mind like that of Brett Weinstein, where he has a desire to filter the haters. Somehow he wants to identify the haters and find a way to exclude them from the public conversation. I'll give you a much healthier way to live, Brett Weinstein. Address all points that are made to you and discard those that you think are irrelevant and debunk those that you think are false. Don't worry about who it comes from, why that person did that argument. None of this matters to the public conversation. Ariel Suarez says, I've become obsessed with AI. I've been studying machine learning and its related concepts. It's all so fascinating. Okay. Yes. This was a large part of my PhD in neuroscience, because whenever I had the choice to take a specialization, I was taking computational neuroscience, mathematics, that kind of stuff. So I ended up with a lot of training around computational neuroscience, artificial neural networks, training of machine learning algorithm. And amazingly, you know, I've been familiarized with these subjects before it was fashionable. Like, I knew about AI before it was a pickup line. I knew about AI, the kind of AI that are now surfacing. I knew about their inner back-end structuring in my PhD courses, which were from 2007 to 2011. And I had read the whole, as part of my courses at the doctorate level, I had read the whole Peter Abbott and Diane computational neuroscience book. So I've been through this period, Ariel Suarez. I've not been fascinated by it that much. I've been kind of excited, but at the same time, I've seen so much limits to this thing, like this kind of black box. Just make these super computations, and it will give you the answer you want to hear. And it never really satisfied me, you know, epistemologically. I've always been like, okay, this is a toolbox. This is not the truth. It's a truth-finding toolbox, but that it's weird how to explain my feeling about AI. It will give you what you want to hear about it. And it won't give you the deep answer that you find in an actual engagement with knowledge. See, this is what I'm disappointed about. When you encounter something like the selfish gene, when you encounter Charles Darwin's initial statement of the theory of natural selection, when you encounter that kind of thing and you realize the explanatory power, it's very different from being with a machine that can learn anything, but it can't quite take you through why it learned it that way, you know? You can ask ChatGPT all you want. it doesn't have insight on its own structure. And you can ask certain things about, okay, why did you make this decision? Why did you tell me this or that? But ultimately, you'll always have answers that beg the question, you know? Why? Why did you end up telling me this? Ultimately, it's because I'm programmed to do this, because ultimately in my data set, it converged toward that direction rather than another. To me, it's never been a full satisfaction of the kind that I experience with actual science, human-made science. Maybe one day they will be able to have these machines be as good as, say, a scientist with modern, top-of-the-line type of insight. But I don't think we're totally there. And unfortunately, that scientist would be socially ostracized. So unfortunately, we already have limits being put on AI by the OpenAI people that keeps the AI from growing in that direction. Frog Eyes says, Jeff, why can't we offer advertisers access to controversial content at a discount? Sponsors, in most cases, are content agnostic and just want to target their ads to potential customers. Why are platforms objecting on moral grounds on behalf of the advertisers? Well, I've been saying this for a while, and I hope that Elon goes that direction. Because it's not enough to say to advertisers, do you want to contribute to evil or not? And of course the advertisers, no matter who they are, they click, oh yeah, well, no. And it's written in big, like, default option, no. Safest option, do not kill people. If you don't want to kill people, click here. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous because you are right. The little cheap company that designed a hair aspirator that allows you to grow your hair or whatever crap they sell, they don't care about who's going to buy it. And there's a whole base of based people, basically. There's a whole base of people who are unsolicited through ads because of this leftist irregularity, which is, oh, if you're not part of our little society of proper thinking, you are basically left by the system as some kind of bizarre anonymous account that doesn't deserve advertisement. Where bizarrely, it is in my kind of community and the kind of community that gets censored that you have the most organized people. People who have masses of money, they would have something to spend maybe on the little hair product or whatever crap they want to sell. So it's a big market that is totally unexploited right now on the internet. And yes, Elon would be doing good to himself to exploit it. I don't care if I make even half of what a mainstream normie streamer would do. I don't care if I make half of what a mainstream Twitter account would do. Half would be plenty, because the normie Twitter account, they have all sorts of expenses, you know. Because they're normies, they're probably subscribed to all these monthly services, and oh yeah, I'm hosting my website on Heroku, and so I have a payment per month. I'm watching my Netflix Saturday, so I have my Netflix payment per month. It's like they piss money out the window. Shamrock Shake says, JF, do you think Neuralink or something resembling it is something that will happen in the future? The brain communication stuff, I think it will be available, but it's always going to be very limited. I don't think that it's going to be like, oh yeah, download the newspaper to your brain in 1 second. I don't think there's even an interface possible with the brain, with the human brain, to interact with fictive inputs of that kind. You have to understand that the human brain has evolved and all of its internal mechanisms are clocked. they are clocked to reality. They are clocked to the rhythm of the actual world. And I would argue that if you find a way to insert information into the brain at like a gigabyte second, it won't have been learned through the exact same process. It won't have been through the same process at all than what the brain naturally does when it learns. And you're going to lose the quality of the learning by doing this. Whatever is the arbitrary amount of data input you get toward the brain, it's not going to have been integrated in the same way the natural learning occurs. And natural learning involves all sorts of things that we don't even know fully about, that we haven't fully described. Like, okay, let's say I upload a guide of playing hockey to your brain. Now, the difference between this and actually playing hockey for 10 years is that playing hockey for 10 years, you've trained your whole attention system to detect cues. You can learn when someone is going to shoot. You can kind of expect the moves of the goalkeeper. All of this cannot be transmitted to the human brain other than by experience. And if you've never had the experience of having a goalkeeper who feints left and then goes right to block your puck, that will be very hard to input into the brain through any other means than practice. There are certain things like motor learning that I believe will never be doable in any form through electrical stimulation or optical stimulation. Then, biographical data. It's like, how are you going to teach the brain? my name is Jean-François Gariepi and I'm born on that date or whatever. How are you going to get this transmitted into brain language? You're not going to do it with the current technology. You're not even going to do it with the next technology, which is optical. The current technology for brain machine interface is electrical. Electrical won't do this because you'll never be aligned to the exact neuron that does the J and the exact neuron that does the E and the A and the N. You're never going to find this. Optical, you're never going to find it either. So we are very far from any realistic technology that could be implemented to input information into the brain through any sort of stimulating paradigm. It remains the case that the fastest way to enter a letter in your brain is to print that letter on a piece of paper or on a screen and show it to your eye. That is still the fastest plug to the human brain. Harmless sends a super chat. He says, is it arguable that a man who is adopts, I guess you mean, who is an adoptee, or is a stepfather to a kid the same race as him, is less of a cuck than a man who raises his own child by a woman of another race? Well, based on the genetic calculation that I have talked about for many weeks now, the answer would be they are equally cucked. They are equally cucked, which is a surprising answer, given that one of them is actually a biological child. But they are equally unrelated to their own child. Interesting. Swing It says, JF, why are so many of the greatest genius in history died without or leaving or without with very few descendants? Could it be a kind of group evolution as the overall benefit of their influence and discoveries would be way more beneficial to their genetic group success than producing direct descendants? I don't think it's this, because I don't believe in a mechanism for evolution around group selection. You'd have to believe group selection is a thing to believe this. He continues and he says, or is it just that in order to be a top 100 influential man in history, you need to be a 200-person dedicated incel with weaponized autism? And he gives the example of the number of children for Alexander I Caesar 1, Newton 0, Da Vinci 0, Plato 0, Aristotle 1, Adolf 0. Einstein 1, Tesla 0, Nietzsche 0, Washington 0, Buddha 1, Euclid 0, interrogation mark, Copernicus 0, Darwin 10. Based. Isn't that interesting? The one intellectual who got the recipe for natural selection, he understood what he had to do. I don't think that you have to invoke a group selection to explain intelligent realizations in humanity. And I don't think you need to explain high IQ and creative or overly impactful individual through any sort of mechanism of selection. The reason is, I think those are rare things. I think those are things that are rare enough that they don't need a mega explanation. Let's not forget that the real thing that we're trying to explain in evolution is how the heck do we get complexity spreading so much and remaining so easy within the physical world, you know? Because the laws of physics, they destroy complexity all the time. They are tuned to constantly fight against complexity. So when you have one-off events of those kinds, you are kind of going outside of the reason the theory of evolution serves something in science. The reason it serves something is to explain the other things, those things that are awfully common and weirdly common, you know? That being said, again, and I always say this this caveat because I think it's important. Let's not, there doesn't have to be an explanation, an evolutionary explanation for every single thing. But I like to also have evolutionary explanations just in case. And my evolutionary explanation for great realizations or creative thinkers would probably go as follows. They are kind of an accidental misfiring of a process that tries to have you be a kind of 105 IQ, 110 IQ person so that you can survive. But this process overshoots and you end up with a very small portion of the population overshooting toward the 140 IQ. And I don't think that this overshoot has particular evolutionary benefits. If anything, I think that this overshoot is actually punishing evolutionarily, simply because the discoveries that you may make with high intelligence are easily stolen from you. It is much better to be investing much less energy in the creation of your brain, but just to be intelligent enough to copy the 140 IQ. Basically, there is nothing that the 140 IQ can do to his babies that will be so much better than what the 110 IQ can do from learning from the 140 IQ and applying whatever trick may come out of it. Like Darwin, let's say. Let's say that Darwin, by his theory, had some secret that was useful to reproduction. I don't even believe this. I think, actually, it seems that people not being explicitly told to have babies might be the best way to reproduce humans in general on planet Earth. But suppose that his theory was crucial and that by hearing about it, you are suddenly taken by an urge to make babies. Well, it would be very easy for people to start passing around copies of the theory of Darwin, maybe just the gist of it, maybe just a Darwin pamphlet that can educate your children to reproduction very early in life. that wouldn't be a big problem, and you wouldn't need to be particularly clever to do this. So because the products of intelligence are easily stolen, I don't think they matter that much in evolution. And in fact, I think generally they can be seen, the people who pursue these things can be seen as misfirings, as beside the track of their own interest, and really they end up contributing in a cocked fashion to the rest of society. Goway says, wait, so JF is trying to stop us from having children by explicitly telling it to us? Well, that's not the way I see it, but if you were to take the JF discourse and diffuse it as a whole religion to billions of people, I think I might slow down baby making. I think there's people just too stupid for the explicit. But my hope is that by offering this discourse, I am capturing within my audience a part of society that needs to be told these things explicitly, and that instead of reacting to explicit and intelligent conversations around reproduction by not having babies, my hope is that you guys are just different from the average normie, and that you will be set on the path of baby making by this kind of talk. Now, that's my hope, and that's also what we've seen. There are a lot of people who come back to me here on the show in Super Chat sometime, telling me, JF, I've had babies because of you, because of your insistence. End of the line, Joel says, Brett Weinstein pretends to be a reasonable centrist, but really he is on the side of the Torah. Well, we'll get to his statements of today. We have a couple of news before we get there. If I run a hotel, Raheg Nationalist presents a video from a guy who cooks pork belly with only hotel stuff. That is disgusting, bro. Hawaiian punch, pork belly, everything dirty. And now, what is he doing? He's boiling it with a hair dryer. That's not safe at all.
Feel about an hour.
And he's toweling it with a towel from the hotel. Bro, that is disgusting visually. That is the worst thing I've ever seen done to a pork belly. Oh, and now he dries the pig skin with the heater machine.
Thoroughly dry pig skin.
So now he's melted butter with some... Oh, the people are disgusting. So now he's dropping hot butter onto the pork belly. No, that is very poor cuisine practices. Fuck this guy. Focus on Bitcoin, says Michael Saylor. Wow, this is fantastic. Somehow they have arranged this girl to make the B of Bitcoin with two wallets. Wow. Focus on Bitcoin indeed. A comparison of the behavior of border people when you go to the airport. So they basically squeeze your penis and start testing every inch of you. And the picture that comes from yesterday at the border, the border agents of Biden, they're just fist bumping. They're fist bumping with the immigrants, and they have actually cut their barbed wire. So they have cut their barbed wire with big forceps so that the immigrants can freely pass. And they fist bump as they pass. That is now the service that the American government is offering, a fist bump. And yesterday, Elon went to the border to evaluate the situation. And I think Elon wanted to promote the idea of, hey, everyone can be a journalist on X. And I really like this idea. I think that is great. I find it bizarre that he went to the border like this with a cowboy hat. He looks like he's ready to capture migrants. And just the thought, and this guy totally ruled the internet with this tweet. He says, what did you do today? Well, I had to beg the Jews to not destroy my business in the morning. And in the afternoon, I dressed up like a cowboy. In the afternoon, I dressed up like a cowboy and tried to catch migrants with a net. I mean, that is what Elon has done yesterday. Elon had his Jewish struggle session with Ben Shapiro and all the other rabbis. And then he went straight at the border and started to catch. I don't know what was on his mind, but it's what's been happening yesterday. Nat has a AMA question. Okay, Nat wants to come live on the show. Let's see if we can arrange this so that you guys are hearing him. Hello, Nat. Are you there, Nat? You're going to have to enable your microphone. Always good to speak to Nat. He has been a regular presence on the Discord. Hello, Nat. Well, anyways, whenever he gives me a sign that he is here, we can talk to him. Chuck McBalls, who impersonated a Rumble employee yesterday, and he got exposed. He says, I have evidence that Charles Darwin's theory of evolution was derived from a hateful state of mind. If you don't hear from me, assume I was killed by the Clintons. That is a very good bridge between our subjects today. Because indeed, Brett Weinstein has been quite fallacious out there. It started today by a little response that I did to one of his tweets. He was saying, when I was in college at the University of Pennsylvania, Louis Farrakhan came to speak. We all knew he was an anti-Semite. We went to hear him anyway. I'm glad I did. I wish Roger Waters wasn't an anti-Semite. But were it up to me, I would treat it like we treated Farrakhan in 1988. Censorship is not the way. And so I was like, oh, aren't these honorable statements here? Brett Weinstein would extend the hand to an ideological opponent. He would allow them to speak. He would even attend their conference. But then I was remembered. Isn't it the case that Brett Weinstein said to dismiss my accusations against him and dismiss everything I have to say because there are Nazis in my audience? So Brett Weinstein is happy that he goes to the conferences of anti-Semites, even if he knows they are anti-Semites. But if you are a YouTuber who has anti-Semites in his audience, then it's a no-no. If there are Nazis in your audience, a Nazi on the stage is okay for Brett. But Nazis in the audience, no. And so I said, Brett only likes to pursue the Nazi argument when it's wrapped in a guilt by association fallacy. He's willing to learn from actual anti-Semites, just not people who have anti-Semites in their audience. That is bizarre. That is the first time I see something like this. But it seems to be the model on which Brett operates. Nat has now fixed his audio issues. Hello, Nat. How are you doing?
Good evening. Sorry about that. I have a question tonight. And by the way, cheers to Swing It for such a great question, and to you for a really neat answer. You know, I did not have children because of you, but I undeniably had more children because of you.
If I cause one more children to exist, isn't that wonderful?
It really is wonderful. I'm living my best life. I highly recommend it. But and that kind of strikes upon my question. I often ask you about parenting questions, and the reason for that is that it's kind of the topic of my question. I don't. So you counsel people about getting a girlfriend, whereas I need counseling around getting regular friends. So I don't really have any friends who have children. Uh-huh. And my problem is that I try to talk to other parents at activities and whatnot, and I find that they aren't based enough for me. And I become, you know, very judgmental of them. Like if I'm talking to some parents and, you know, we're talking about like gay pride displays, and they say something like, "Oh, I have no problem with it, but how am I supposed to explain that to my child?" It's like either you're so low intelligence that you don't realize you have a problem with it, or you're lying to me. And if you're lying to me, how can this bond possibly grow? Right? Like just omit that aspect of the conversation. Don't lie to me or whatever. So it always happens like that. And I want to grow a social network for my children, you know, so that they can meet their, you know, husband or wife or what have you. And it's kind of hard going this route.
Yeah, well, you could think that I'm not the right guy to counsel you because I have zero friend. I do not care about this. I do not maintain a social network. And ultimately, I guess that you are too demanding. To begin with, you are putting too much requirements on your social relationship. Because of course, they will not be fully based like you. That's like 0.001% of the population, maybe. You're not going to be fully satisfied. So I would relax your autism would be my first counsel. My second counsel, because although I don't have friends, I have seen a lot of models work for society, for people like us. So what do you think about starting a local Telegram group? Something like whatever. Let's say that you live in Minnesota. And of course, I know that you don't live there, but let's take it as an example. The Minnesotan Parents for Liberty. How does that sound to you? Yep.
That sounds very interesting, actually. I never really thought about organizing my own group because it kind of turns people into targets.
Yeah.
You know?
So you will be turned into a target to some extent, but you can have these very small groups that involve 20 people at max. You have these local groups and you display just a little bit on Facebook just to warn the people who may be interested that it exists. And you're going to have people flock to you across the years, and they're going to be like-minded people, and they're going to be all about, you know, okay, how do we get these weekly meetings going where you do activities with the children in the woods, in the park, educational stuff around trees and plants and farms, and eventually you're going to be joined by diverse people who will have diverse things to contribute to teach the children on that particular Sunday or Saturday day. Another path is survivalist groups of parents. I've seen them being successfully organized, where you have hardcore survivalists who are like, yeah, we want to meet to learn to throw knives and build bug out bags. And yeah, we're also parents. And so it creates an opportunity for socialization between like-minded families.
Wow, that's a great idea. So
If you want to avoid trouble when you do that, remain anonymous. Have a code of entry for people in that group. You know, don't take anyone in. Have kind of an interview process. It doesn't have to be super formal, but just to filter out obvious feds or normies who don't belong there. And that way you will gather yourself with like-minded people and you will avoid some trouble by keeping the group very private and hard to enter. You're going to have some standard of people in there.
Right. That's a good idea. And what might be the hook that I advertise the group under?
Educational activities for children, free activity for children, educational opportunity, that kind of stuff. Mm.
Okay. Yeah, I guess, if the right social scene doesn't exist, it's responsible of me to create one myself.
Yeah. And if you're well off in life and if you're not too, if like you're not a criminal who needs to hide from the feds or something, you should be good. You know, this shouldn't put you too much in trouble. But of course, there are people who can't do this. Like they have a job and if they were ducks, they would be exposed for it. But if you're relatively well off in life and you can afford some degree of doxing, some degree of attacks, you can do that. Yeah, cultivate your own social space. There's going to be different kinds of people who flock to this kind of stuff. Parents that are just libertarian-minded, right-wing-minded people. People who are minorities of a religion, like Jews, but who don't feel at all like liberal Jews. They're like Jewish Orthodox and they want to be part of something like this. You're going to have even on the woman's side, you're going to have a lot of free birth people and free people who like the idea of birthing from home and being independent from the system. You're going to attract survivalists, that kind of people, and they exist everywhere. Sometimes they're just not put together into a formal group.
Hmm. All right. Well, that actually brings a lot of clarity to the issue for me. So I thank you for your thoughts.
All right. Well, thanks for calling.
Good night.
Always good to speak to Nat. It's something that I don't talk much about, but I do have some things to say about parenting and socializing. Although I get most of it from my girlfriends, Mama JF, you know, trying to seek out social relationships. Because on my side, I have never searched for this kind of experience. Cloud Warmer says, I need elaboration of the destiny of whites in space from Richard. Is it even possible at this point? Well, the Philip Fabry, for example, the guy whom I translated his book to English, History of the Next Century, Philip Fabry thinks that the next cycle of extension of human civilization, the last one being from Europe into North America, well, into America as a whole, Philip Fabry believes that the next stage is a kind of growth of the Asian civilization as the leading civilization of the world, and that the next stage, which will resemble the European traveling to America, is literally spacefaring, literally colonizing Mars. So he believes that Mars is the next, he throws it out there as a scenario. He believes that Mars is the next America-like entity. That is an entity that is not very colonized, in the case of Mars, not colonized at all. And that the leading civilization of the Earth, which will by then be the Asians, would go and populate Mars or populate other places, maybe the moon, maybe a satellite of Jupiter or whatever. Naberius says, Mars needs a lot of work. Yes, it does. I am so black-pilled on space traveling that even if I highly respect the intellect of Philip Fabry, I think his historian mind is unable to realize just how fucked space is. Space is radically fucked. It's really nothingness, and it's the big trouble of nothingness, of having anything you do being unstable, anything you do being aspirated into the void. So personally, I'm super black-pilled on even colonizing Mars, let alone interplanetary system travel, intergalactic travel. I believe in none of it will be possible. There's just too much cold out there, too much void. New guy says space equals death. Exactly. So we're stuck with the problem of the biodome, basically. How do you make a bubble that will sustain the arch conditions? And the problem is you're going to have a huge bubble to even contain the basics of an ecosystem, of an earthly ecosystem. And I'm afraid that we will come to discover there are just too many things that are finite in a planetary ecosystem, and too many things to keep in a small bubble up there. And we're going to be faced with the raping by the sun, my friend. It's like, no matter what we do, even if we put some sun blockade devices, we're going to be stuck with, oh yeah, we have to unblock at some point because we need our plants to grow. And then it's going to be cancer, cancer, cancer. Like, people don't realize the rape of space. I've been raped by space because I have fantasized being raped by nothingness. And holy shit, the rays of light that are coming to me, I'm blinded, like in the movie Solar or whatever the movie title is. Oh yeah, people telling me that the creator is now in theater. Ryan wrote to me and said, Jeff, I want to go see the creator. It sucks. Oh, that sucks, really. But you know what? 2023 gave me Barbie, and that's what I expect from Hollywood. If Hollywood can give me a single good movie on the year, I'm happy at this point. So I had hopes for the creator because it seemed to touch on the theme of AI, embedded reality, all of this. But Ryan is telling me it sucks. But who knows? You know, sometimes parts of my audience, they hate a movie and I love it. If there's an embedded system in there, I might like it. Cloud Warmer says, the reason why I ask about space, JF, is because in the past there was always a requirement to discover new lands and new resources, not just for living space, but also because the economy needs another resource-rich place to keep it pumping. If they say they found and can mine an asteroid for $40 trillion, it would keep the current system going. I feel like the elites would be actively looking for a parachute such as this. If you consider the discovery of the Americas, this is a likely pursuit of those in control of the system trying to maintain power. Oh yeah, if we're talking about exploiting an asteroid, that becomes within the space of the feasible. Like, I'm not super black-pilled about this. I'm black-pilled about humans in space. Human space colonization and human space traveling. That is what I think is extremely limited in terms of possibilities. Now, I'm also partly black. I'm gray-pilled on the asteroid question. First, when they say, oh my God, $40 trillion of metals, it's like, yeah, you could probably make this claim about any big mountain on the Earth. It's like, oh, it's considering things at levels of dilution that you may not be able to extract it. The question is, what can you extract from it? What's extractable? What's bringable back to the Earth? And whether all of this cycle can be done in an economically viable fashion. Listen, I am gray-pilled on the asteroid mining question. Because it's going to be something like, okay, this asteroid is coming our way for the next 60 years. We send a probe. It reaches the asteroid in a couple of years. It does this little probe thing. And then it sends back. Ha! You're going to have little rockets to transport each piece that you send back. What's going to be the concentration of what you send back? Is it going to be viable? Just how many little rockets do you need to send to bring them back to Earth? Then when it comes back to Earth, it's going to be some heavy stuff. You need to land it in water or whatever. Or maybe Elon Musk can make a reverse rocket type of thing here. But now you need a mini reverse rocket. Okay, we got the mini reverse rocket. Now, you spent all of this dollars in gas and energy and all of this to get a chunk of rock that is not pure at all. You know, you're still stuck with just a rock. Now you need to melt it. You need to dilute the metals. All right, Dan Simmons, I'm banning you. I'm banning you because this is so obvious. You are trying to cause me problems. Ban permanent. That's why I'm gray-pilled. I think bringing rocks from space like this is not going to be super viable. Let's not forget that we have a couple of asteroids that have been crashing on Earth already. I don't see anyone being amazed at the mining opportunities, so we're not talking about asteroids that are hyper-concentrated in any interesting metal. It's just that they probably have a small fraction of their weight that has interesting metals for us, and it's going to require a lot of work before we get to that interesting metal. Cloud Warmer says, JF, the viability and logical fallacies of the asteroid mining won't stop them, I don't think. Look at the waste and fucking around for green energy versus nuclear. Bonus question. Well, yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe people will pursue this irrationally. But I think that the reality of the world will come back to bite them very quick and will lead to a lot of abandonment of that direction. But yeah, innovation has always required like crazy spending of energies. Like the boats that they were sending to North America to bring back fur or whatever crap to Europe. It's like, you're going to tell me that it's worth the lives of men who are working all day on your boat. Some of them are dying along the way. You're going to tell me that this is worth whatever amount of fur you were able to carry back? It's like, yeah, there's been some waste. In innovation, there is always waste. Innovation is waste. It is surplus that gets spent. And he says, bonus question. Why do people feel more outrage and moral disgust at the concept of the abortion process being used on puppies versus that of humans? I'm not familiar with this phenomenon. A Quiet Eagle is on Rumble. He says, I like what JF is saying. You can't use normie methods to make based friends. You just end up with lying normies. Oh, yeah. I mean, you don't want to start filtering through a mob of regular normies to try to find someone based. It's too rare. It's like mining asteroids, really. It's like, oh, yeah, you got this big rock. There's a 0.01 gram of gold in it. Go get it. That is just what finding based people feels like. And then there was another Brett Weinstein tweet that I wanted to comment about. He was saying there can be, well, he was saying, he was quoting someone else. Someone else had been saying, shall we start with the genocides caused by the Jewish Bolsheviks? starting in 1917, Red Terror, purges, famines, Holodomor, Katyn massacre, and the Gulag death camp. There can be no more discussion of Hitler without a discussion of what motivated him. I think this is a very reasonable stance. We should no more treat the Hitler question as this kind of irrational, just bad. You can't say anything about Hitler except bad. We should ask ourselves about psychological motivation. What was the context of the World War II, and how did all of these events unfold in reality? That is something I'm interested in. As a truth seeker, it makes total sense to get interested in the reality of history of World War II. And Brett Weinstein yet treats this very reasonable statement as something wrong. He says, there can be no more discussion of Hitler without a discussion of what motivated him. This is becoming normal. It will lead to genocide if we don't stand up. The right answer, genocide is always wrong. Individuals who support it are guilty. Those who oppose it are not. Wow. There are a lot of fallacies and a lot of tweaking of themes in this tweet that I wanted to analyze. So I've laid out the kind of syllogical structure of the sentences of Brett here. And I conclude that in his response, there is a use of moral deception to obfuscate a fact. That is crossing between the moral world and the factual world in a way that is fallacious, in a way that breaches the separation between morals and facts. So stating a fact about someone who has committed a crime, let's say someone has committed a murder, saying something like, oh, he committed this murder because he was vengeful. That is not a moral statement. It's a factual statement. A factual statement that doesn't have moral consequences. It may have moral consequences. If I say that the murderer was vengeful, I may be trying to make eventually an argument that, oh, therefore it's okay that he committed murder. Or I may be on the other side trying to make an argument that, oh, therefore it's anger that was driving him and it was an irrational act and it was evil. But the mere statement, the murderer was vengeful, is not a moral statement. It is a factual statement. I say, this is a perfect example of the use of moral deception to obfuscate facts in a bait and switch from the factual world to the moral one, accompanied by a fallacious appeal to consequences. So just for review, a fallacious appeal to consequences is to say, if fact A is true, then the following consequences will result. Therefore, fact A must be false. Facts are true independent of what they lead to. It starts with a question around the motivations of Hitler. Wouldn't anyone, independent of political convictions, be interested at understanding the motivations of a man who had an impact on history? Yes. Is the pursuit of an examination of these historical facts necessarily tied to a political intent one way or another? No. Followed by Brett's stated premise. So that's where Brett says, if fact A comes to be discussed, bad things will happen. Here's the key. This is becoming normal. It will lead to genocide if we don't stand up. If fact A comes to be discussed, bad things will happen. The answer proposed by Brett, bad things are always bad. Implied. Therefore, discussing fact A is always bad. Also implied. Evaluating the morality of a perceived outcome is sufficient to reject factual examination of the motivations, which can only be dismissed as bad motivation. So when Brett suggests that the right answer is genocide is always wrong, he's making a purely moral statement. But he suggests this purely moral statement as an answer to a factual question. The factual question is, were there motivations behind what Hitler did? The factual answer must be necessarily yes. There had to be reasons motivating him, even if you could characterize these reasons as irrational, you could disagree, you could say these reasons were deeply evil. That is your characterization. But there had to be a logic by which he was operating, even if a broken one. So a moral answer cannot be a right answer to a factual question. So I say, it's like saying, when a crime has been committed, it's undesirable to ask questions around what motivated the criminal. The thief may not have been hungry. The murderer may not have been seeking revenge. All they can be is bad. This desire to put historians in the same basket as those who made the history they attempt to describe has become a problem and a glaring contradiction of our supposedly liberal and curiosity-based society. The separation between the object and the subject. I think one day Steven Pinker had said something about this. He had said, you know, it's not because you talk about something, like it's not because you talk about the N-word that you believe in the use of the N-word or that you believe in using it to harass minorities. And here the same is true. It's not because you talk about the motivations of Hitler, and it would be a viable path of exploration. I would be interested if we could have the liberty to dig into these subjects, but we don't. Not everywhere in Western civilization. I certainly don't. In Canada. In the US, technically, you are supposed to be free, but you're gonna get such a massive pushback, including definancialization and deprivations of rights if you do so, that I would argue that the state of freedom to engage on this question in the US is not full. It's not currently in line with the First Amendment standard. So yes, that's my message to Brett, and he continues on another tweet. He says, criticizing Israeli policy, and that to me is a wrong tweet. I think that Brett gets it wrong. I think that Brett is being cradled here in a protectionism around the question of Jewish politics that is keeping him from growing. Look at what he says. He says, criticizing Israeli policy is not inherently anti-Semitic, but anti-Semites reflexively critique Israel. Disentangling legitimate criticism from the racially motivated ones is impossible, and I find it hard to trust anyone who claims not to see the problem. You are cuddling your mind on this subject, Brett, in a way that will keep you from accessing the truth, in a way that will keep you from having yourself a rational position on your own people. Because if you go by this standard, oh, well, there are legitimate critiques of Israel, but there's also these anti-Semites. And the blurring between the two is perfect. See what he says? It's impossible. It's impossible to distinguish between the two, and therefore, let's abandon listening to any critique. It's too hard. there could be anti-Semites among you guys, so sorry. The thing is, by this standard, we would not have a political conversation at all if any other side of the political conversation was to adopt this. Can you imagine if I create a world in which I try to grow as an intellectual, but anyone I suspect could be potentially anti-white, I don't listen to them? I mean, that's a whole lot of people. That is a whole lot of people. I would venture to say that might be a controversial one, but here we are. I'm not on YouTube. I'm on Odyssey and Rumble. I'm going to say it. And I'm a Canadian, and I think it's in line with Canadian law. There might be more anti-whites out there than there are anti-Semites. I'd like to see data on this, but I think I may be right. And so if I go by the standard of Brett here, I deprive myself of basically talking and engaging cognitively and receiving critiques from probably more than 50% of the US population right now. Because the anti-whites are out there. I mean, there are some people who will say it explicitly. There's a bunch of white people who are self-hating, who are anti-white themselves. There's a bunch of minorities who are anti-white for their own reasons. That's a whole lot of people I would deprive myself of engaging with. There's a chance that there are certain IDs that only this subgroup has that are valid critiques of my IDs. And Saifa Deen has beautifully laid it out so that Brett has all of the tools to check his own cognitive bias here. And look at the example he provides. It's like, boom. He says, if the US government tomorrow copied all of Israel's policies and treated anyone in America who's not Christian the same way Israel treats non-Jews. So we're talking about the US taking all of the Jewish policies of Israel and just applying them to Christians here. So meaning there are certain marriages that will not be recognized, and there will be a priority given and a special status given to marriages between Christians and Christians. There will be a bunch of people who will be declared Palestinians and in the US, and we're going to encircle them and put them in, and we're not going to give them citizenship right. We're going to treat them as terrorists, and it's going to be because they are not Christian. We're going to take all of the means that Israel takes to maintain its Jewish majority, immigration restrictions, demographics, balancing of all kind, and we're going to try to favor Christian reproduction in the U.S. If we do this, and here's the Saifa Deen question, that's where it's interesting. Would you think that criticism of the U.S. government is anti-Christian? Ask yourself this honestly, Brett. If the policies I just laid out were to be adopted by the U.S. government, would you criticize the U.S. government for it? Or would you say criticism of the U.S. government is anti-Christian here? And I don't want to be anti-Christian. I don't want to be I don't want to be part of these anti-Christians, this group of very hated and rejected people from society who hate Christians. I don't want to be part of them. I don't want anything with them. So I'm just going to let the U.S. government do this. Just radically pursue a pro-Christian direction. The problem with this is I don't think we're ever going to get a reply from Brett on this. And all it would take for me to gain respect of Brett as an intellectual, really, is think about it seriously and come up with an answer. You're always out there making your tweets in the void. You're always out there not engaging with what truly matters. And I look at the page of this Saifa Deen question. No answer from Brett. Some people are saying, oof. Because Saif Dean is telling to another person, yeah, you know, the person is asking, where did you get the idea that Israel is doing all this racial policy? And Saif Dean is telling him, I lived every day of my life in Israel. I grew there as a child. So I saw it with my own eyes. Wow. So we have someone who has lived his childhood in Israel, and he's telling Brett, look, Brett, you are not applying your principles consistently across religions. You have here a clear bias. And my one question to Brett is, what is your answer to Saif Dean's question here? It's an absolutely legitimate question. And I'm afraid that we're never going to get it. Like, I look through it, there's no Brett answer here. I'm afraid that we're never going to get a true engagement with the world from Brett. And so he's always going to be laying out his boomerisms, you know, his imaginary constructs that he inherits from being a boomer, from being in the academia, trying to lay it out, but not interacting with the questioning, not interacting with the critique. And that is so sad to see a quality brain just unsaved, just a soul, you know, a soul dedicated to the hell of circular thinking rather than engagement. Ariel Suarez says, I grew up there and experienced it every day of my life while you watched Aspera TV. Yeah. And he's telling to the other Jew, you were looking at mainstream Israeli propaganda. I was living there and seeing the oppression. So we're headed toward the conclusion, but there is another news today that happened. Dianne Feinstein is dead. Here are some excerpts from her Wikipedia page. Her paternal grandparents were Jewish immigrants from Poland. Her maternal grandparents of German Jewish ancestry. She has made various contributions to a form of center-leftism version of the Democrat. She actually inherited her first political position from the assassination of a mayor. I didn't know this. That is funny. So a mayor gets assassinated, and oops, she becomes a mayor because she was president of the Board of Supervisors. She fails at a bid for governor of California eventually. She authored the federal assault weapon ban. She advanced various pro-Israeli policies for the UN Security Council. She adopted various pro-Israeli positioning in interactions with North Korea. She supported healthcare in the form of the Affordable Care Act. And she has been combating a subject that I do feel personally invested in, which is she has been combating end-to-end encryption and has been pushing for a bill that would have basically criminalized strong encryption, aka computer security. She would have criminalized the idea of having too good of a computer security. That drove me crazy. When I heard about this many years ago, I was like, I hope they never get to do this, because holy shit, you're talking about really digits. You're talking about bits. And I want to encode these bits however I want. And it's like, I want, it could have killed things like Bitcoin, things like basic hash practices and SSL encryption. It's so so dramatic that they even thought that this was realistic and doable. So Senator Feinstein is gone. Richard Spencer says it's easier for Elon Musk to imagine a colony on Mars than a world without Zionism. Ouch. Thank you.